I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Russian government is refusing to extradite a former KGB agent who, British officials say, murdered another former agent. British prosecutors say Andrei Lugovoy poisoned Alexander Litvinenko using a radioactive substance known as polonium-210. Litvinenko died in November. But the Russian government says Lugovoy, a Russian citizen, can only be tried in Russia. The case has more intrigue than a Russian spy novel and threatens to frost already chilly relations between Russia and the UK. Joining us with more is Edward Lucas, International Section Deputy Editor at The Economist magazine in London. Ed, can you start by reminding us who Alexander Litvinenko was? To start, a critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin.
He certainly was. Alexander Litvinenko was a career security officer in the Soviet Union when it was still the Soviet Union, and then moved into that kind of shadowy world of somewhere between security and business. He ended up leaving the security service, claiming that he'd been asked to organize the killing of one of the richest men in Russia, Boris Berezovsky. He then was jailed for a bit, then escaped from Russia, and ended up in London along with Mr. Berezovsky, who became his kind of protector and financed him. And he then made a series of increasingly, I wouldn't say bizarre, but certainly striking allegations against the Kremlin, saying that the Russia was behind international terrorism, that President Putin was a paedophile and so on. And then he mysteriously was poisoned with this polonium, this very rare and expensive radioactive substance, and died a very public and agonizing death a few weeks later.
What was his connection with Andrei Lugovoy, the man accused of poisoning him?
Well, Mr. Lugovoy came over to London and had tea with Mr. Litvinenko at the Millennium Hotel here in London, along with a couple of other Russians, both with KGB backgrounds. And it's not absolutely clear what happened there. They seemed to have some business to discuss with Mr. Litvinenko, and he went along quite readily to the meeting. And it wasn't clear whether they were trying to meet Mr. Berezovsky through him, whether they really had business to discuss or what. There's a lot of stuff that's very unclear about this even now. Although what is clear is that the radioactive trail and Mr. Lugovoy's involvement are very closely associated, that radioactivity has been found on the planes that he used in the places that he went to. And I think that was the key thing from the point of view of the British prosecutors.
You mentioned Boris Berezovsky, another Russian exile now living in London, also involved in this case. He became a close friend of Litvinenko after, as you say, Litvinenko says he was asked to kill Berezovsky. Now, The Guardian is reporting that Russian officials might consider exchanging Lugovoy, the accused poisoner, for Berezovsky. Why would Russians want Berezovsky?
Well, Mr. Berezovsky, from his downtown luxury headquarters here in central London, organises a lot of anti-Putin, anti-Kremlin activity. He has a lot of money and not very much to do now that he's been exiled. And so the Kremlin really doesn't like him, and they would like to extradite him back to Russia to face charges for fraud and other things based on the time when he was one of the richest and most powerful men in Russia. And I think they would see that as something of a swap. But, of course, the difference is that the charges against Mr. Berezovsky are highly political, and the charges against Mr. Lugovoy are fairly straightforwardly part of the criminal justice system.
And how do people in Britain feel about this case, given that the killer also risked harming others? There were traces of this poison found across London. Several people tested positive. What are people there saying today?
Well, I think it's really brought home to people the danger that comes out of Russia. You know, we're used to having lots of Russians here, and they buy expensive apartments if they're rich, and they clean the streets if they're poor. But you know, there's tens, maybe even hundreds of thousands of Russians living in Britain, mainly in the southeast. And for a lot of the time, we don't see the kind of the dark side of Russia, and this kind of outbreak of what was really nuclear terrorism on the streets of London, which endangered the lives of tens of thousands of people actually contaminated 17 who are going to have to watch their health in future and to have regular checkups. That's really, I think, scared and also annoyed people.
Yeah. Well, with just the few seconds we have, it seems it's a stalemate for now.
I think that it's a stalemate in terms of the criminal justice system, but I think there's a lot more to play out on the political and particularly the commercial front. Our biggest company, British Petroleum, has a vitally important investment in Russia that the Russians are on the point of confiscating on highly spurious legal environmental grounds. And I think that that's going to be the next thing, that Russia's going to put the squeeze on British companies and make sure that Britain pays a commercial, economic price for having dared to make a political, what the Russians see as a political thumb in the eye for the Kremlin.
So this definitely hasn't helped British-Russian relations. Edward Lucas, International Section Deputy Editor at The Economist magazine in London. Edward, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Artillery and machine gun fire echoed around a crowded Palestinian refugee camp for a third straight day today, as the Lebanese government ordered its army to finish off the militants holed up inside. There was a brief ceasefire earlier today. It ended when a United Nations convoy trying to get relief supplies into the area came under fire. There were reports that food and medical supplies for civilians in the camp, really a small city, are running out, but also reports now that convoys have gotten in. The fighting between the Lebanese army and the al-Qaeda-inspired group is also raising fears of more violence in other camps and a backlash against the Palestinians living there. In the fighting that started Sunday, at least 29 Lebanese soldiers have been killed, along with at least 20 militants and an undetermined number of civilians. So what's going on in Lebanon? Who are these militants? And what does this have to do with recent violence in that country? We want to spend a few minutes today trying to understand what's going on inside Lebanon's latest crisis with Fawaz Jurjez, Carnegie scholar this school year, spending most of his time in the Middle East, including in his native Lebanon. He usually, though, teaches international affairs and Middle Eastern studies at Sarah Lawrence College. His latest book is Journey of the Jihadist, and he joins us from Washington. Fawaz Jurjez, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you, Robin.
And it seems as if we always speak to you when Lebanon is in crisis, which is frequently. There was Israel's war with the Syrian-backed militant group Hezbollah last year. Before that, the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, the ouster of Syrian troops. This fighting now being called the worst since Lebanon's civil war, which was 75 to 90. But we're also told there are only about a couple hundred members of this Islamist group holed up in the camp, Fatah al-Islam. So where do you put it? How serious do you think this is?
Well, actually, I'm not as concerned about the battles in the last 3 days, the fierce battles, even though the casualties are extremely high. Mm. I think it's a major fault line, because it seems to me that Islamist militancy is migrating not only into Palestinian refugee camps, but into some enclaves in Lebanon, into some Sunni-dominated enclaves in North Lebanon and South Lebanon as well. What I'm concerned about, Robin, is that there is an intense internal crisis between the Lebanese government on the one hand and the opposition led by Hezbollah. And this particular internal crisis has polarized Lebanese society for the last 8 or 9 months. There's also another fault line, and that is pitting the Lebanese government, the pro-Western Lebanese government, against the Syrian government. As you know, some Lebanese officials pointed fingers at Syria for sponsoring and arming the so-called Fatah al-Islam, the Palestinian group mm-hmm. that is engaged in fighting with the Lebanese army. What I fear is that not only the recent battles may escalate and spread into other Lebanese towns and cities, but the recent crisis might overburden an already fragile political system in Lebanon and push Lebanon into the brink of all-out war.
Well, you've bitten off a lot there. Let's take one thing at a time. First of all, you mentioned the fragile Lebanese government. This is a coalition of Christians, Muslims, and Hezbollah, the militant group that's backed by Syria. And you said the Palestinian group, Fatah al-Islam. Let's be clear about this militant group, because we're being told, first of all, we want to find out more about what you think this group is, but we're being told it may be holed up in the Palestinian camps, but it's not necessarily made up of Palestinians. These are fighters from outside the area.
Well, Robin, first of all, just for your listeners, we are doing a great deal of speculation.
Yes.
On Fatah al-Islam, and really a note of qualification is essential. For the last 3 days, every American news outlet has been talking about al-Qaeda. Those are not al-Qaeda fighters. Those are mainly and mostly 99% are Palestinian fighters who subscribe to a certain version of Islamist militancy and whose leaders have expressed sentiments supportive of Al-Qaeda, but 99% of the members of Fatah al-Islam are Palestinians, are located in North Lebanon in a Palestinian refugee camp called Nahr al-Barid. Mm. But let's remember, not just Palestinian refugees basically are expressing support for the ideology of Al-Qaeda. Many Sunni Lebanese in Tripoli and other towns in North Lebanon also subscribe to this particular ideology. I don't know if you remember, if your listeners remember, in 2000, on the eve of the new year, in 2000, there was some intense fighting between the Lebanese army and some Lebanese members, the so-called Afghan Arabs, who returned from Afghanistan and who basically subscribed to Al-Qaeda's ideology. Dozens of Lebanese army and members of the militant group were killed in 2000. So I think, first of all, mostly they are Palestinians. The evidence shows that there are a few militants who have come from Yemen and Saudi Arabia. We know very little about those fighters, but we know the conditions inside the Palestinian camps, and I think we should really tell our listeners about the dismal conditions that exist within or inside Palestinian refugee camps.
We want to do that. We want to speak about these camps, which, as we know, are not really camps, but stone houses, cities, in effect. But before we do that, just to be clear, because what's confusing to many people is that this group, Fatah al-Islam, is not, at least as we can tell, being supported by Hamas, the militant Palestinian group, or Hezbollah. What is different when you say their ideology? What do you mean by that, the Al-Qaeda ideology that this group is expressing? And we have about a minute and a half before we take a break.
You know, Robin, really, this is a very critical question you're asking. In fact, Fatah al-Islam, the current militant group that is fighting the Lebanese army, has been harassing other Palestinian groups for the last year or so. And in fact, neither the Palestinian Authority groups nor Hamas or Palestinian Jihad support the actions and the tactics, the murderous actions and tactics of Fatah al-Islam. This is not just a Lebanese-Palestinian divide. It's also an intra-Palestinian divide. Not all Palestinians, in fact, a very tiny fraction of Palestinian public opinion within the camp support Fatah al-Islam. My fear is that if the Lebanese government escalates the fight, if many civilian casualties occur in Palestinian camps, that is Palestinian public opinion, particularly Palestinian refugees, who are almost 400,000 Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, may easily have empathy for Fatah al-Islam, and then the fight may easily escalate and expand.
This is Fawaz Jurjez, Carnegie scholar this year, who's been spending a lot of time in the Middle East, including in his native Lebanon. He is, of course, a professor at Sarah Lawrence College, has made visits to us frequently. In that capacity, he's also an author. His book is Journey of the Jihadist, in which he describes what he says is the new jihadist way beyond Osama bin Laden. And we want to talk to him about that and how this group might fit into that thinking of his. And further, you know, what this means that this group has sprung up in Lebanon. Fawaz Jurjez, you hold right there. We'll be back after a quick break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back continuing our look at the recent violence in Lebanon. Since the weekend, Lebanese forces have been trying to defeat a small group of Islamic militants holed up in a Palestinian refugee camp north of Tripoli. We've been speaking with Fawaz Jurjez, professor of international affairs and Middle Eastern studies at Sarah Lawrence College, and someone who is Lebanese. His most recent book, Journey of the Jihadist, Inside Muslim Militancy. And Professor Jurjez, you were talking about how this group is caused intra-Palestinian fighting. Tell us more about the book and about the group in the framework of your book, Journey of the Jihadist, in which you speak of, you know, a third wave of militancy, basically saying that bin Laden and al-Qaeda are not where it's happening. Where does this group, in your mind, fit into that thinking?
You know, Robin, the so-called the jihadi current or the jihadi movement no longer exists as a systemic coherent movement. In particular, in the last, since 9/11, or in particular since 2002, we can no longer talk about a jihadi movement. We should be talking about pockets of global jihad or local jihad, pockets of local jihad that basically exist in multiple theaters in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Yemen, in Saudi Arabia, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan. And what's happening is that not only Al-Qaeda tactics are being used by certain militants, but also Al-Qaeda ideology is migrating into some of the poorest ghettos in the Arab world. And in this particular sense, in fact, I am not surprised that Islamist militancy, Al-Qaeda's ideology, has migrated into Palestinian refugee camps. In fact, I'm pleasantly surprised that not too many Palestinians have joined this particular militancy because of the dismal conditions that exist in Palestinian camps. And I would argue that I call those particular pockets of local and global jihad, I call them the Iraq generation. That is, I give him a broad name, because in particular we cannot really understand the new trends within the jihadi currents without understanding the ramifications of the American-led invasion of Iraq and the subsequent developments there.
Now let's talk about the camps, because we've been calling them camps, but they're not camps. They're cities. This is made up of Palestinian refugees who started arriving in 1948 when the UN created the State of Israel. Also came in 67 after the war. And they have, from what I understand, are completely autonomous. The Lebanese army usually never enters the camps, which also makes this a different situation. You describe them as horrendous. We understand they're some of the most densely populated areas in the world. What is expected to happen to them?
Well, Robin, really, you cannot understand the rise of Islamist militancy, of the migration of Al-Qaeda ideology into Palestinian refugee camps without understanding the dismal socioeconomic and political conditions that exist there. There are about 400,000 Palestinian refugees who live in about six or seven refugee camps. You might really call them more of towns and tiny cities. Some of the highest densely populated urban areas in the world. Let me just give you a kind of a glance into life inside Palestinian refugee camps. I have visited those camps on multiple occasions. Life is very hellish inside Palestinian refugee camps. I wish I could convey to your listeners the extreme poverty and deprivation and alienation that exist inside the Palestinian camps. There are no services whatsoever. The Palestinians have no legal rights inside Lebanon, no employment, no rights to education or even medication. In fact, the Palestinians live in almost small prisoners, because most Palestinian or all Palestinian camps are surrounded by basically security service of the Lebanese army. More important, Robin, here is that years of conflicts in Lebanon, in particular the war between 1975 and 1990, embittered Lebanese public opinion against the presence of large number of Palestinians in Lebanon. And I would argue, as a Lebanese here, is that Palestinians are mistreated as a result of those years of conflict. And this is why, despite the migration of militancy into Palestinian refugee camps, I'm really pleasantly surprised how few Palestinians have decided to join the militancy. And I would argue that the most effective way, or the most effective means to combat this form of militancy, is to enable other Palestinian groups, in particular the groups that come under the Palestinian Authority, to deal and disarm and preempt people like, or groups like, Fatah al-Islam. And the Lebanese government must endeavor to avoid large number of civilian casualties, because we don't know yet the extent of civilian casualties. But based on we know, and I was raised near the Palestinian camp in north Lebanon, Nahr al-Bared, very densely populated. And we know that Fatah al-Islam members basically position themselves within the population. Any shelling of their positions will likely cause multiple dozens of civilian casualties. This is what I fear.
Fawaz, we've got about a minute and a half left. It would seem that even if this militant group is subdued, others might spring up, given the situation you described, it would seem that it makes it even more important for either the two-state solution in the Middle East or the countries like Lebanon integrating these people living on their soils.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, Robin, the big fundamental challenge facing the international community is to find answers and solutions to the predicament of the Palestinian refugee problem. I mean, think about it. For the last 3 days, we've been talking about terrorism and Al-Qaeda and Palestinian camps. How many of us have taken the time to talk about the predicament of 4 million Palestinian refugees who are basically spread across the international continent? I hope that a fundamental solution that takes into the account of a Palestinian state, a Palestinian homeland for all Palestinian people.
Professor Fawaz Jerjes of Sarah Lawrence, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And for more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. We'll keep you updated on this story. Much more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Food and Drug Administration is expected to decide today whether to approve a new birth control pill that would do away with menstrual periods. If approved, the new drug Libril would be the first birth control pill to suppress bleeding altogether. Three other contraceptives on the market greatly reduce bleeding. Well, news of Libril, which is manufactured by Wyeth, has supporters applauding the end of menstruation and detractors saying the new drug hasn't been adequately tested and that it's unnatural. Well, Dr. Timothy Johnson is medical editor for ABC News and a contributor to Here and Now. Doctor, tell us, first of all, how does this pill work? How does it compare to other forms of birth control?
Well, regular birth control packages have 21 days of active pills, that is, they contain hormones, estrogen, progestin, and then usually 7 days of so-called dummy pills, which cause breakthrough bleeding. This new packaging will simply have the active pills given on a continuous basis without any so-called placebo pills. So the hormones will be constant, and therefore, theoretically, there will be no bleeding.
Well, here's the debate in the medical journals, just a taste. Baltimore health psychologist Dr. Paula Derry wrote the British Medical Journal that suppressing menstruation is unnatural and untested. Dr. Sheldon Siegel at the research group Population Council wrote back that a British study found no harm in taking pills with even higher hormone rates than these pills have, these new pills have, for 10 years. So where do you stand?
Well, I would argue with both the words untested and unnatural. Every time a woman gets pregnant, menstruation stops, so Mother Nature, in a sense, stops periods at least for 9 months, and if the woman breastfeeds during that period also. And we have been experiencing women for many years who, either on their own or often in conjunction with their doctors, will take the pills on a continuous basis. That is, they'll just skip the placebo pills and keep taking them, and have been doing this for many years with no evidence of any danger. And as was suggested, there is some data, even using higher doses of old style pills, that women taking them for as long as 10 years had no problem. So I don't think it's unnatural, and I think the evidence to date is that it doesn't pose any danger.
Does some of this just boil down to personal choices? I mean, some women may feel that a period makes them feel more fertile, more healthy. Others may feel it makes them feel anxious and annoyed and messy.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think it's very much a personal, emotional, lifestyle choice for most women now that they have these options. And as you've pointed out, many women have taken birth control pills on a prescribed basis for excessive bleeding or excessive pain or other excessive symptoms during menstrual periods. So many women have used birth control pills to treat their periods, as it were.
And by the way, we know that existing pills were also given out for other reasons, for treating acne, for instance, skin conditions. Is that done anymore? And are there other health benefits for taking either this new pill or the other pills?
Well, I'm not aware that it's being widely used now to treat acne. There are many other drugs available for that purpose. It's used primarily in terms of an actual prescription, as I said, to treat problems with periods such as excessive bleeding, which, of course, can lead to anemia.
Right.
Women who use the pill also seem to reduce their risk for endometrial cancer. So there are some other female cancers that may be reduced in risk from women who use the pill, although they're not usually prescribed for that purpose alone.
But are there any women, and just to remind ourselves, that should not take the pill, either this new one that suppresses menstruation entirely or claims to. We should say early studies of this pill, there were some women that did have some breakthrough bleeding, even with the new pill. But are there women who should not take any kind of birth control pill for any other reasons?
Yes, women who are at high risk for blood clotting should not take the pill, even with its much lower doses. It's much safer today than the pills originally, which had much higher doses of the hormones. But certainly a woman who is at high risk for blood clotting, particularly older women who smoke, who are at higher risk for blood clotting, most doctors would be reluctant to prescribe any form of birth control for such women. As to the breakthrough bleeding you referred to, because the doses of hormones in this new pill are so low, it does seem to lead to some breakthrough bleeding, especially in the first few months of use. And about 18% of women in the studies looking at this new pill dropped out because of that breakthrough bleeding. So that may be a problem for some women.
And by the way, Doctor, before we let you go, we understand that a very, very, very small percentage of women still get pregnant on birth control pills. And the concern about this new pill is they may not know that if they're taking pills continuously.
That is a concern, and that is one of the facts that will have to be looked at in terms of studying the pill as it's used. And with any form of birth control, there are some pregnancies, and that's more likely to occur, quite frankly, with these newer versions of the pill that have much lower doses of the hormones.
Right. And if you're taking the pills continuously, you may not have those few days where you might feel the symptoms.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So take that into consideration as well. Dr. Timothy Johnson, medical editor for ABC News and contributor to Here and Now. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, staying with health, we turn now to Alyssa Eli. She's a psychiatrist and a longtime observer of the human condition, working with patients with severe illnesses. As she tells it, her daughter once reminded her that suffering is relative.
There's a moment in the weekly service when the rabbi calls out the names of congregants who suffer, as he says, from illnesses of body or spirit. After he finishes reading, he looks up and says, "If anyone else would care to add a name, raise your hand and I'll be honored to call on you." Hands go up, he points, and the air is filled with more names. Names without details, names spoken and gone like fireflies. Behind the name is someone with a cancer, a stroke, new-onset diabetes, depression. There is no end to the illnesses of body and spirit. My little girl likes this part of the service. For one thing, it means announcements are near and pastry is coming. For another, it's a kind of public distinction. There's something thrilling to her about speaking up, like waving wildly in class with the right answer. It disappoints her that we don't have the answer every week. One night as the moment approached, she leaned over. "Put your hand up," she whispered. "For who?" I said. "For Joanna." Joanna is a girl in her class who has always struck me as bursting with health. I've never known her to have illness of any kind. But my own girl was so clearly distressed that I put my hand up. The rabbi called on me. "Joanna," I said. He thanked me and pointed to the next hand. "What happened to Joanna?" I whispered. Now I was worrying. It had been a couple of days since I'd noticed her at pickup. The most robust child can be afflicted at any time, and what happens to yours can happen to mine. "What's wrong with Joanna?" My daughter's voice was filled with feeling. "Head lice," she whispered. No hands were left in the air. The service was coming to an end. We all bowed our heads, those of us who knew Joanna and those of us who didn't, and we prayed for her speedy recovery.
The thoughts of Alyssa Eli, a psychiatrist from Belmont, Massachusetts. Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, from preaching on the stoop of the Disney store in New York to getting thrown out of the Mall of America, we'll speak with Reverend Billy with his gospel of anti-shopping. You're listening to Here and Now. Ah, that great moment in classical music history. Cartoon characters Tom and Jerry in the episode known as The Cat Concerto. The cat in tails, his own and a tuxedo. The mouse asleep in the piano, but not for long. Actually, it turned out to be a moment in musical history because watching in his home in China many years ago was 2-year-old Long Long, and he fell in love. He began learning the piano at the age of 3, winning major awards and performing publicly by 5. He came to the U.S. and studied with Gary Graffman at Philadelphia's prestigious Curtis Institute of Music. And at the tender age of 17, Long Long was tapped to stand in for pianist Andre Watts, launching a trajectory he's still on at 24. He's toured worldwide, released recordings of Tchaikovsky, Mendelssohn, and Rachmaninoff. And now for the first time, Long Long takes on Beethoven. In a new CD, he plays the composer's concertos for piano and orchestra, number 4 in G major, opus 58, and here, number 1 in C major, opus 15. The CD just debuted at number 1 on Billboard's classical chart, and Long Long joins us on the line from the NPR studios in Washington with more. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you, Robin.
I mean, are there times when you pinch yourself?
Yeah, I mean, this Tom and Jerry cartoon really inspired me a lot.
What was it about them playing that tickled you at 2?
The really interesting thing was that Tom is so incredible with his finger. His finger can do so many things that as a human being you cannot do it. So the cat's always a great way to describe pianist. And as you know, if you describe, oh, he plays like a cat, that means great.
We want to talk about the music on your new CD. I mentioned 2 particular piano concertos. By the way, why Beethoven now?
I've been working on Beethoven Piano Concerto No. 4 for a really long time, I think around 9 years already. And I really love this piece because it's so difficult to play and it's so introverted. In the past, I did lots of pieces which is really firework pieces. Mm-hmm. And I like to do something that to really play something which is normally people don't expect for me, for my playing.
It's interesting you say that, because we've asked other musicians about you. One said you were a super virtuoso. Is that not good in your mind to be thought of as a technical superstar?
No, it's fun. You know, I think everything, if it's positive, it's a good. But for me, my goal is not just being a great technical player. I want, in the same time, to be a great musician as well.
You talked about wanting to add to your repertoire and your reputation being one of someone who just dazzles. We have a little bit of that, too, that comes in the first movement of the first piano concerto that's on your new CD. It comes about 12 and a half minutes in. Well, actually, 12 minutes and 40 seconds. I timed it.
Oh my gosh.
It's just this spectacular piano solo. Let's listen. Exhausted just listening to it. What are you feeling when you're playing that passage?
This is really incredible emotional contrast between explosion and peace, kind of like a warm peace. And I think Beethoven really shows his 2 sides of creation. And I think this is one of the very dramatic sides of Beethoven.
Twenty-four-year-old Chinese pianist Long Long will be back with more after. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. That's 24-year-old Chinese pianist Long Long, spelled L-A-N-G-L-A-N-G. He's just released a new CD of Beethoven piano concertos. You're listening to the third movement of Piano Concerto No. 1 in C major. Long Long performs it and Concerto No. 4 in G major with the Paris Orchestra under the baton of one of his mentors, Maestro Christoph Eschenbach. Long Long, you've been working on the fourth piano concerto for the past 9 years. Let's talk about the meaning of the music to you. In previous interviews, you've talked about how music has characters. Every note has a character. You've compared it to Shakespeare.
For Beethoven, I think Beethoven admires Shakespeare for many, many things, and many musicians admire him.
Well, let's go through the three movements of the fourth concerto, just a little bit of each, and tell me what characters are on your mind. Here's a little of the Allegro first. So what characters are there for you? What are you envisioning?
I think this is Hamlet, because I think he's very pure in the beginning, but then he had such a complicated life, then he tried to really do something about it. And you see, this passage is really from beautiful pureness into a kind of really complicated kind of sadness.
Yeah. How about the Andante? We'll listen to that.
This is basically, I mean, I think Beethoven has already had a really great demonstration that he said, this is obvious, that he's praying for his wife to get out from the underworld.
From Hades.
Yes.
Orpheus and Hades and the Furies.
He almost succeeded, actually, but then because he looked back on his wife, then everything disappeared. So it's enormous music, actually. This is piano is him, and then the orchestra is the represent the underworld.
You're so quiet here. What's it like when you're performing this, to have that huge sound and you have the smallness, and the piano does interchange ultimately, but what's that feeling?
It's enormous. It just feels that you are really lonely on stage when you have this kind of enormous contrast between this really heavy, hard orchestra sound. And then it comes, I mean, you feel you are hopeless.
Yeah. Let's listen to the rondo. Lonely here. I mean, you have a little more of a voice.
Yeah, I mean, it's very positive. The third movement is certainly, it's one of the happy characters from Shakespeare. You have lots of jokes around.
Jokes?
Yeah, jokes. Ding, da-da-da-ding. And then get upset for one moment, and then comes back right away. So it's really kind of lots of unexpected themes. Thank you.
for now. We understand that when you go to home to China, you're mobbed by people. The New York Times says you are the hottest thing in classical music. What do you project? What are you thinking is ahead for you at 24?
I think in the future I'd like to do more education program around the globe. And I like to inspire more young people to start listening and play an instrument. And I think it's important not just listening, but to play piano or violin or whatever, and to really enjoy this wonderful art creation, which all those great composers created in the past.
We understand that you're part of may have launched a tidal wave of young Chinese who are coming to music schools in the U.S., apparently online. Applications for the New England Conservatory and Juilliard, and you know this, are just through the roof. What would you say to a young person who says, I'm going to play fast and furious like Long Long? What would you say to them is the key to whatever it is that you seem to have?
I think the one of the important things, it's just really enjoy music and really enjoy the what is already exist, which is the love in your heart for music. And if you always remember that, I'm sure you will get a successful career, or even you don't get a great career, but you will feel music in a really deep way, and also will change the way of your thinking life.
How has it changed the way you live your life, music?
Music always, you know, like, it really changes my thinking of life. For example, a great piece like the late Beethoven sonatas gives me more confident on my life. I'm not just talking about music, because there's so many hardship inside of this enormous harmonies and this dissonant things and soft in the end. And so it always gives you energy to live in a better way in this world.
Because you see how dissonance becomes harmony.
Yes.
Yeah.
The struggle becomes something spectacular in the end.
Chinese pianist Long Long has just released a new CD of Beethoven's piano concertos. It debuted number one on the classical charts in Billboard. Long Long, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We leave you with a little more of Long Long's second movement of Beethoven's Fourth Concerto for Piano and Orchestra. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI.